I can't fix death, unfortunately. So,
No.
I think when you explain it to patients that way, most of them say, yes, please give me the blood thinner. The risk of bleeding is much less severe than the risk of death.
Hey guys, it's Mel, your host of the Cutting Edge Podcast. This is a show where we talk transformation from every angle, body, mind, and confidence, with a little sparkle and a whole lot of truth. I'm joined by my amazing co-host, Dr. Omar Betas, and the plastic surgery pro, and Ashlyn Douglas Barnes, our go-to therapist and mindset queen. Now, quick disclaimer, none of us are your doctor or therapist. We are just here sharing real talk, real stories, and real growth. So grab your protein shake, settle in, and let's get into it. This is The Cutting Edge.
Hey, it's Ashlyn. Just one more thing before we begin. I will be sharing some of my own plastic surgery journey, which is personal to me and may not reflect what others go through. And if you're a current client of mine, please talk with me first before listening, because knowing personal details about me could affect your therapy. And your well-being always comes first. Now on to the show.
Welcome back to the Cutting Edge Podcast, and I am your host, Mel.
I'm Ashlyn Douglas Barnes, licensed clinical social worker, bariatric therapist, and bariatric patient.
Omar Betas, plastic surgeon, board certified by the American Board of Plastic Surgery, and specialist in plastic surgery after weight loss.
Holy moly. Mm. We got some experts on our hands. I love this. So again, I'm Mel. I am a bariatric patient who would love to get plastic surgery one day. And it's kind of perfect that I do have two experts that you should have with you when you go and do a consult. I do believe you should have a therapist on hand so you can bounce some great ideas off of. And then, of course, your surgeon, you're going to want to meet them and ask them a ton of questions. So today, what we're going to be going over is travel, because you don't have to stay in your own state to get your surgeries, guys. You could go literally wherever you want. So I wanted to ask, you know, the experts here of like, is there places we shouldn't go? Are there safer than others?
We're just going to jump right in to,
yeah,
where are we? Okay.
I know. One question. Where should we start?
Oof. I don't know. Where should you not go? Is that your question? Was that the first?
I guess no. Then we'll start first with, is it safe to travel while you get your surgery? Just regardless.
I think so. We have plenty, you know, personally, we have plenty of people who come to our practice and seek us out because of the work that we do. I would say routinely about 20 to 30% of our patients now come from out of state. Okay. So not only are they like maybe driving from Miami or Tallahassee, for people not from Florida, like myself a few years ago, those are like 3-4 hours away from Orlando by car. People aren't generally flying that distance, right? But we've had people as far, I think, Connecticut in the last few months, okay. Alaska a few weeks ago, Dubai over the summer, England, South America. So we get a fair amount of people from all over the country and all over the world as well. So,
well, then that proves the point. If you're coming from South Africa or the UK and things like this, then like it's obviously safe to come in, get surgery done. How long do you recommend them at least staying like in the city?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? And that's usually one of the first questions we get asked by those people is how long do I have to plan to stay? Things like, am I going to have drains? What's the recovery? But the number one question for those out of town patients is how long do I have to stay in town? Ultimately, it depends on what surgery or surgeries you're having done. I would say it ranges from about a week to sometimes 2 to 3 weeks. That, you know, generally, I think to answer the first question, which I don't think I really answered, it is safe. I think you just have to make sure you line up with a surgeon who does it safely, right? Because it can be dangerous to travel in the sense that you can go to a country where it may not be safe or a city. But also traveling in and of itself, you know, getting on a plane, or even if it's a long car ride, someone from Miami coming to Orlando, which is 3-4 hours, that increases your risk of blood clots in the calves, right? And we call that a DVT. And general anesthesia, if you're having surgery, also increases that risk. So now you've kind of got two strikes against you. And then certainly there's other factors like age, how long your surgery is, if you've had a previous blood clot, if you're on hormone therapy, if you're on birth control or something with estrogen. All those things, you know, being a woman increases your risk factor. So
Of course it does. Why would it? Oh boy.
And so, you know, your surgeon, if they're not, if they don't have a lot of experience in this and they don't do this safely, you can have a big problem traveling, right? So we take all those things into account. A lot of our patients from out of town, we will, we call it prophylaxing someone. So kind of pre-treating a risk factor, which is a DVT. So we give them blood thinners the morning of surgery. And sometimes you send them home with a blood thinner for 30 days. So I think all those things you have to take into account. But yes, traveling definitely is a risk. And you just have to find someone who does it safely. So depending on how far you're traveling, what surgery you're having done, it can range from 7 days to generally no more than 2 weeks. But I've had patients who came from, like my lady from Alaska, she stayed almost a month. Not that we told her to. She just chose to stay 4 weeks. Her husband golfed while she was recovering. Yeah. They had like an Airbnb. They've done, this is like her second stage with us, I think. So she's done this more than once. But generally, I'd say 7 to 14 days is average.
So would you give anybody a blood thinner just to be like, if, because they're traveling, like they're taking a flight in a week, or is it only because they have like pre-existing?
Would I give anyone a blood thinner? So there's calculations in plastic surgery. I will say none of the ones that are published are great. So we've kind of devised our own scale based on, they weren't made for plastic surgery. They were made for general surgery or orthopedics, for example. So we don't have one that was specifically studied plastic surgery patients. So the best thing we have is someone who took a bunch of general surgery patients and then some plastic surgery patients in order to kind of like extrapolate what they thought was a good scale. I would still say it's not great. And even if you follow that scale, you can have a pretty high risk of blood clots or DVTs. I would say prophylax most of our patients. You know, if your BMI is a risk factor, depending on where you fall, you know, not getting up and walking, not getting up and walking is a risk factor. And, you know, when we do like a 360 lower body lift, some people are up walking that night. You know, if they're super motivated, they're at the gym. Other patients are almost like mostly in bed for the first week. So again, that's another risk factor. So, and we don't know. I mean, sometimes we can tell who that is, but sometimes you just don't know how a patient's going to do after surgery. So it's safer to just give them the blood thinner. You know, the thing I tell patients is, yes, bleeding is bad, right? But I can go in and I can fix you if you're bleeding. I take you back to the operating room. We open the incision. Find what's bleeding, stop it, close you back up. It costs you another trip to the OR, right? I mean, is that bad? Yes. I can't fix a clot if that clot dislodges and goes to your lungs and kills you, right? I can't.
Hey, friends. This episode is sponsored by findabariatrictherapist.com because bariatric life is full of ups and downs and everything in between, but you don't have to go through it alone. FindABariatricTherapist.com makes it easy to connect with therapists who truly understand your journey, the mindset shifts, the identity changes, and all the real-life challenges that come after surgery. Because therapy designed for bariatric patients changes everything. Visit FindABariatricTherapist.com and find your support today.
I can't fix death, unfortunately. So no. I think when you explain it to patients that way, most of them say, yes, please give me the blood thinner. The risk of bleeding is much less severe than the risk of death.
Yes. That's actually why I asked, is because one of my biggest fears is actually dying from a blood clot, just because you don't really know what's coming. And so I've always been nervous of having like an embolism. Is that what it's called? An embolism.
Embolism, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I was like, would you just give it to me so that I could feel more comfortable knowing like there is like a way low chance that could happen? Because I'm thinking in my head, okay, because guys, I live in Oregon, he's in Florida. So if I went to Dr. Beta's, I know that's a 6.5 hour flight there and back. And so I'm thinking in my head, okay, I'll stay there for about a week, but then that 6.5 hour flight and not being able to be mobile, like, you know, I think I would want a blood thinner, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So, 6.5 hours is, it's funny, even myself, like when I travel, if our flight's longer than 2.5, 3 hours, I wear compression socks. And I make my wife wear them because, again, travel by itself, air travel is a risk factor for blood clots. And my wife hates this, but every time we're traveling, I pull out her compression socks and put them on her dresser the night before so she knows to wear them the next morning. And She hates wearing them, but she, you know, she knows that she has to.
So. Yeah. Well, now I know. I'll start wearing them when I come see you guys. That's for sure.
And it is interesting because, like, I have a condition that increases the risk of blood clots, though I've never had one. And so we have handled things a little differently. The last surgery, I didn't fully know that at that time, but, like, I
increases your risk of clotting or bleeding?
Clotting.
Clotting. Okay.
So I have something called Mathurner's, and it's a compression syndrome in the left leg and the vein that brings from your abdomen into your, and it's like a 73% compression, which is really bad. I probably haven't had a clot because I lost all the weight and didn't have a pregnancy. Like, there's all the things that they were like, you should never do any of these things because it could cause a blood clot. I was like, okay, didn't do that, fix this, you know. So, but it is interesting because I potentially am going to have a hysterectomy. And so now we're on this, like, conversation that I've never had. So none in my previous plastic surgeries do we ever do a blood thinner.
You had it then, or they didn't?
No, we did not know I had it then.
But now we know.
But so now that I know. Yeah. But I will say I don't take opiates. I get up really quickly. I had a very strange adverse reaction that got reported to the FDA for an injection of what's the blood thinner we normally give through injection when you have
Lovenox or heparin is the other one. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a very, very weird reaction. It like bubbled up to the top of the skin and made hundreds of tiny little scabs when I had bariatric surgery and caused an infection. Mayo Clinic had to report it to the FDA as like a rare adverse reaction, I think is what So there's an alternative we figured out because one of my surgeries, they did give me one. When I had my hiatal hernia repair because I just couldn't, I wasn't well med managed from a pain standpoint, and I really was having a hard time getting out of bed, which is ironic. That's the one that knocked me down. And all the stuff I've had, that was the one I was in the hospital for like 3 days. Oh, it was terrible. That was like the worst surgery I've ever had. Which is weird because that was the one that I was like, I'm going to be fine. We booked a hotel at the beach. We're going to go chill. And they were very kind and let me cancel. But the Mayo Clinic pharmacy was able to find an alternative that was also injectable, but I can't remember. I just remember the like 10 students from pharmacy came down to like talk to me so they could have like a teaching moment. I always end up being a teaching moment medically. And they're like, so this happened. And there's, I'm like, there's pictures in my chart of it because it had to be reported. And so they concluded there's some other medication they use. But now there's kind of this question of like, what do we do? Because now we have this information and we need to do something about it. And it is, it's interesting because I also have that fear of just dropping dead from a blood clot because you just never know.
Yeah.
It's scary.
I'm that weirdo that wants to know. Before it happens, I want to know that I'm dying. I don't know. That's the deal. Well, here's the thing. I've been around a lot of death in my life, like a lot of family members. I've watched a few people pass. So it's like, I'm scared to die, but I'm not scared of the dying moment, I guess.
The process of dying.
Yeah. Like, I'm not scared of the process. It's more like, I want to know, like, okay, like if they say, Mel, you have cancer, you have a year to live, like that's fine with me.
Well,
like,
so that's what I was going to ask. You want to know so you can plan, or what if it's like you have cancer, you're going to die in a month? Or like
that's fine. I just need to know. Like I just need to mentally prepare. Yeah. I need to mentally prepare for it.
Yeah, I want to know.
No. I got shaken heads. No.
I want to be the lady who has the cake and she's walking the cake to see everyone she's ever loved, and she falls into the cake and dies, and everyone is around her is like, she lived a good life in the end. Like,
that's perfect. That's perfect.
So I'm prescribing my own death, by the way, right?
It's you're manifesting your own.
Like, church lady, I love it.
I love it. Well, speaking of death.
Getting off of suffering and death. And
we'll stay on it a little bit. Are there places that we should just not go because like the risks are that high, you know?
I don't know that I would say that I would like X out a place just being a place, right? I think, countries have different safety profiles. So I think definitely pick your country with care.
Think about a country you would not want to get a blood transfusion in. And then
I think
that country because you might need one.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable you know, a reasonable statement, right? I mean, if you are in trouble, like if you have a complication within the first few days of surgery, you're bleeding, like, you know, Ashton, you just mentioned, you need to go back to a hospital. I'm not sure I want to be in a third world country. You know, safety standards, cleanliness and sterilization standards differ outside the U.S. You know, again, so certainly most European countries are going to be okay.
Yeah, one of the weirdest complications I ever saw was a woman who had been to the Dominican Republic, got some kind of bacteria in the lipo wand, and it like
rotted
out her skin. It was the weird, it almost looked like permanent bruising, but also like concave. It was one of the strangest, and it was a bacterial infection because of unsanitary.
And I mean, you know,
it's another country.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying, like sterilization protocols, right? They don't, they may not have them in the country, but not everyone's going to follow them. You know, they may not have the same governing or accreditation bodies that we have here in the U.S. You know, and even in the U.S., not to say that it's the safest place, but definitely there are standards. And again, not to say people don't cut corners, but you know, you're at a major hospital, they're not cutting corners for the most part. Surgery centers, again, same thing. Those places are... they have site visits by these governing agencies, and they're checked on their sterilization standards, their safety standards, you know, a whole list of things that these agencies go through when they do those visits. And for the most part, even like an in-office surgery center or surgery suite will have that. Now,
what are
some
like red flags that it's a chop shop? Because I think like we all kind of know the idea, or you could like, I guess, say the idea of like a chop shop. But like, how would you know when you went in there, you were like, ooh, I'm in the United States. I'm thinking it's going to be a standard outpatient hospital setting or whatever it is. And then you walk in, like, what are reasons to like, you know, back out
maybe
of the
door? Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a great answer because I've never seen a chop shop, but I've kind of heard from patients who, you know, had a complication or were scheduled and then, you know, for some reason canceled. The few things I've heard, you know, you don't meet the surgeon till the day of surgery. I've had this and a lot of patients I think are afraid to speak up, but they show up the day of surgery and it's a different surgeon their meeting, you know, so they had the consult with Surgeon A, they show up to surgery and Surgeon B is marking them. I think that's a big red flag. You know, I'm sure it sounds like they're given an excuse or something. You know, I think that that might be a time where you need to stand your ground and say, you know, my consult was with this person. This is who I want to do my surgery. If that was indeed, I imagine if you went and saw that person, that's, you know, why you chose them. And I know it's tough, but I think you can say I want to delay, I'll wait, you know, whatever the reason is. And I think if the other option is to get your money back and don't let them push you around because you didn't sign up for surgery with Surgeon B, you signed up with Surgeon A, right?
I was about to say that. Don't let them bully you. Do not let them push you around because that's also a sign that they're doing something they shouldn't be doing.
Correct. Yeah.
And you need, like, I would even explain to them, be like, hey, man, I don't know you. And I'm going to sleep for a while. I want it to be with a person I had this long conversation with that at least remembers my face and knows what we're doing today. Like, yeah, do not leave that place without your refund. Call someone if you need backup. Like, you do not leave until you can get that refund out. But don't let them touch you.
A red flag, like even within the consult about like asking how many they would do in a day. Or they're just, I know there are some surgeons that just do more in a day, but like if you're getting some, like what is a number that you just be like, if they said they'd been doing that many cases in a day, or your surgery was scheduled really at a weird time or,
Yes. And we hear that, I mean, again, we live in Florida. So I think we hear a lot of crazy things out of Miami. I would say, if your surgery is scheduled at like 6, 7 p.m., it's probably not a great thing. You know, do you want your surgeon having already, you know, we start generally between 6 and 8 a.m., right? Do you really want your surgeon, let's say 7 a.m., has done 11 hours of surgery and they're starting your surgery at 6 p.m.? Like, that is not, you know, safe. It's not a good idea. Clearly, someone just looking for volume, not looking at quality. You know, I do think the day of you can have delays where maybe your surgery was just supposed to start at 3 and you get pushed down and now it's 6. You know, we do that every once in a while. That happens. Luckily, it's extremely rare. But unless I'm tired, I'm okay doing the surgery. I'm not doing it every night where I'm working till 8 or 9 p.m. And sometimes we talk to the patient and say, hey, like, it's late. We can reschedule you for tomorrow, the next day. Maybe it's not a good idea to start the surgery at 6 or 7 p.m. And I've done that a few times, right? I don't want to start a surgery at 7 p.m., especially if it's like a 3-hour case.
See, and that's how you know you have a good surgeon, is someone that's actually like thinking about things like that and actually goes, hey, this one lasted longer than we expected. Let's move you to a different slot because I want it to be safe, which, you know.
I always felt better when I knew that surgeons would delay, because I knew that meant something, they felt like something needed to be done and they did it, instead of just being like, well, that's all the time. Because I would imagine in a chop, like, you're not going to fix it. Like, you're just, you got to keep it rolling because you need that volume. Yeah. Because my guess is that volume is that they're paid on production. And so they need more production in order to make more money. So they're actually driven to do more and more, or get more people in, or do it faster, or like, what is the drive maybe there that's causing some of that safety?
It's volume. You're right. You know, so if you, you know, we talk about like BBLs in Miami and breast dogs.
Are those, you know, the big two?
Those are the big two. I mean, they're very common surgeries. I think nationally, breast augmentation is the second most common. BBL is probably up there. Liposuction is number one. Those price out between $3,000 and $4,000 in Miami. Like, you'll see ads, $3,000 to $4,000 for a breast aug or a BBL. Our price is closer to 7 to 9 for those two, you know, 7 to 10, let's say, for those two procedures. Yeah. So to be able to do breast aug, BBL, let's take BBL, for $3,000 or $4,000, that's like a 3 to 4 hour surgery, and it's pretty intense because you're doing 2.5 hours of lipo and then reinjecting the fat that you've harvested. That's not like an easy surgery that I want to do two of in a day, right? In Miami, people were doing like 9 of them. This is not an exaggeration. This was like, yeah, like, you can look this up in the news. They had to essentially make a law to cut down the number of BBLs that you can do in a day. What was happening is, you know, if you can sign up 10 people to do like 10 BBLs in one day, that's $35K, right? So that's volume now. You've just created a lot of volume coming into your practice. But what was happening was, because again, it's an intense procedure, you might have like, you might have 3 or 4 rooms going. They had assistants in each room doing the harvesting. And then the surgeon would come in at the end of each surgery and just re-inject the fat.
Yeah. I've heard this scary in a different way, where this guy was doing up to 10 surgeries in a day of like, I think it was our bariatric surgery, or could it be general surgery? But he had the same thing where he basically was like the main guy, and he would check on all the rooms, and it would be the assistants or the like, the doctor one down that's like in, you know, like learning, that was actually doing everything. And he would just come in. Like, there was a whole write-up about him too. It's fucking crazy.
And you know, in training that
liposuction.
Sorry?
Of all the types of liposuction is the one you're having them.
Yeah, which, you know, it's funny. People think lipo is,
he puts some X's and
the BBL is the dangerous part, right? I mean, that's where we had, that's where people die.
Right. But if I don't know, I guess as an uneducated, I would be like, okay, surgeon's going to do the lipo. He's going to throw some X's and tell the assistant to like inject where he put an X. I don't know. You know, like,
yeah.
I thought it would be flipped. Ooh. It seems odd that the assistant would be the one doing the lipo.
Yeah. I mean, they're both dangerous, but I would say, you know, especially like,
I didn't realize the fat part was dangerous.
Yeah, before they mandated that you use ultrasound, a lot of, you know, they had a peak of deaths, I think it was in 2019 or 2020, from BBLs. The reason they were dangerous was because people were putting the fat in the muscle, in the gluteus muscle, right, the butt muscle. But there's a lot of big veins there, and so when you would put the little cannula in, which is the kind of like a metallic hollow rod that you inject the fat through, if you ended up in one of those veins and injected enough fat, you would create essentially a blockage with fat that would travel up to the lungs, kind of like a blood clot traveling up there instead of a blood embolism or a clot, it's called a fat embolism, and then people died.
You're literally dying on your own fat.
Yeah.
Does it feel just like a regular embolism? Like, how would you know if you were having one of those?
Yeah, shortness of breath. I mean, some of these people didn't make it, like, very far, as in, like, off the table or, like, within a... Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty quick thing. They start to decompensate in the operating room many times, because that's where the fat just immediately blocks the...
Yeah, none of these are in hospitals, so it's not like we would then need to, like...
Well, no, that's actually how Kanye West's mom died. Was mm-hmm. that way. He paid for the surgery and everything, and then his mom...
Well, that's why he's...
Yeah, and that's why he's all fucked up, because, like, oh my God, I know I would be. I'd be like, I just paid for my mom to die. Like, this is crazy. So,
was that surgeon a plastic surgeon, though?
I don't remember. Oh.
Okay, Google that. Probably not.
Damn.
Or maybe but it seems weird. It's Kanye West. He could have paid for the most.
I know, but I think that's where it was ironic.
Oh.
Yeah, because, you know, quality.
Well, because people do get frustrated when they come to Florida and they can't do their... I've had clients that are like, oh, I'm going out to some other state because I can't have as much lipo. And I'm like, you can. You just have to be in a hospital and pay more money.
Yeah. And the deal is like, it's probably 100% for safety. And that's probably the issue how we were talking offline of like how I've gotten contacted by outside countries wanting me to come in and get work done. And
this
I'm
is
like,
crazy, by the way.
Yeah. You guys be careful. Look at all the things. I told them no.
People who are Instagram famous, listen to us.
Yes.
Do not do this.
Do not do this. Do not go to cosmetic surgeons. Don't go to them. Check their credentials online. You actually can check all this stuff online. It's public record to make sure that they're certified and all those things. So
some states, you can also see if they have certain levels of malpractice against them.
Yep.
In Florida, they have to be pretty severe to actually be able to see it on the licensing board. But
you can. In Oregon, you can.
It was down in Miami, though, right? But she was just getting lipo.
Says breast reduction.
A breast reduction.
Oh, see, I thought
she died the next day. Lipo and a breast reduction.
Yeah.
How'd she die? I don't remember this very well. I may remember the story, but.
Well, that's why we had the law that why you can't do so much lipo in Florida.
No, it's not. Is it really?
Yes. He's the one who campaigned that law.
No, really? I guess I didn't know that history. I know we have a law. I just did not know that was the cause of it.
We would put lipo law, Florida, due to Kanye West.
You know, while you look that up, so there has been a lot of laws around this whole Miami Chop Shop thing that, you know, you mentioned, Ashlyn. So one is you have to meet your surgeon at least... I'm not sure if the law says like 24 hours before or at least one day before, like one calendar day before your surgery. So definitely I think that was, again, kind of the point I made earlier is people showed up and they were suddenly seeing someone else or they met a nurse at the consult and then they were meeting the surgeon the morning of for the first time. So that's a law in Florida. And again, I think in general, it's a bad idea if you're meeting your surgeon for the first time.
So I am spreading misinformation. the law was passed in California after the death of Donna West, Kanye West's mother, but there's no direct evidence that the law in Florida was created due to this. However, it contributed to a national conversation about plastic surgery safety and influenced stricter regulation in Florida and other states. So they made the Donna West law is the California law that limits the amount that they have to receive physical examination and written medical clearance within 30 days. And because it ends up that she had had a pre-existing heart condition and was operating on a surgeon who is not board certified and did not require prior medical clearance.
Oh.
Prior medical clearance.
Wait, but he was not board certified? See, that That's I remember something. So I wonder if he trained as a plastic surgeon, but then pass his boards certified.
It says the Florida law particularly came after the Brazilian butt lift craze.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Specifically the 2024 one.
So you can't meet your surgeon the day of.
Don't do that.
They couldn't. I think they put a stop on like how late you could start a surgery. This is all in Florida specifically. They put a law on how many BBLs you could do. I believe it's 3 in a day. I have personally never done more than 1 in a day. It's a pretty major surgery. Like I said, it's not something you want to do 2 of in a day.
Yeah.
People were doing some wild shit. Mandatory use of ultrasound, in-person examination.
Yeah, you have to. So now, then
It must be.
I think the ultrasound one came later. So now, yes, you have to use ultrasound if you're injecting fat into the buttocks. And it can't be in the muscle. That's now illegal to put it in the muscle, which, I mean, for safety reasons, we don't do that anyway.
Extubated?
Oh, yeah, like the breathing tube pulled out?
Yes, they must have that.
Intubated.
E-X-T-U-B-A-T-E.
Who must be extubated? The patient?
Yes, before any other procedure is done. Says the fat must be injected into the subcutaneous space only, and the patient must be extubated before any other procedure begins. I wonder what happened that was like a thing. And then there's a limit in 24 hours. So people were doing like one day and then another day coming back for more.
The limit for 24 hours, I think, and how many you can do, no? Not
1,000 cc's of... if you want to remove more than 1,000 cc's, you must register with the Department of Health. Hmm. What would you even register as?
You never had to do that much.
Micro-suctioner.
No, we do more than a liter. I do a lot of my surgeries in a hospital, too. So some of these laws, you have to be careful. They don't apply to hospitals. They apply to surgery centers and in-office suites.
And then it upped how much you could sue them for. Mm. That's interesting.
Well, because there was a big, big problem with BBLs for a few years, wasn't there?
Like, yeah, that's what I'm saying. In 2019, 2020, there was a peak of like 20 deaths a year. Or it might have been more than that, but like 20 out of Miami.
On the hours, too, which I didn't realize. So the maximum planned duration for elective cosmetic and plastic surgery in an office is 8 hours.
I mean, that's way longer than it should be probably in an office, to be honest with you. I mean, we do those in the OR, but to do 8 hours on someone in the office seems insane.
That does, because even when I got my implant on out of my arm, because I lost so much weight, because I got it put in when I was like 300 pound Mel, but then it was time to take it out when I was like 185 Mel. And so my arm was open for almost an hour. And she was like, I am so sorry. Because, like, she's like, you should not be in this room that long with it not being completely sterile. She's like, you're open. She's like, so just be careful with infection. Don't move your arm too much, because it curled under my muscle in my arm. And so it came out like half straight and the rest was just because it moved and got stuck up in my muscle. So, but like, yeah, my arm.
No, in your muscle?
Yeah, that's what she said. My arm muscle.
So, did you get an old one or a new one? What year was this? The old ones did do crazy shit like this because it was
bad. Oh, okay. You're talking about old surgeon or
it was
old,
Nexplanon?
This was Implanon.
Probably Implanon. So the it old was Implanon. Implanons had not as bad as the one from the 80s that had like actual prong things in them.
Yeah, like I haven't had it in since 20.
I used to work in family planning. I know like, maybe like much about family planning.
So I had my surgery 2015, so I would say about 2017 is when I got it removed.
That probably was so going on then.
So.
Okay, wait, let's go back to places you wouldn't travel, shouldn't travel.
But
so,
anyways, yeah, back to places of don't travel.
Yeah, so places, as Ashlyn said, where you may not want to get a blood transfusion. So basically, I think like third world countries for me, you know, people can do what they want, but that would be out. Probably even like second world countries. So make sure you're going like, you know, Europe, France, Italy is going to be safe.
Israel.
I know there's a lot of...
Israel.
Yeah, I know a lot of people...
Maybe not.
That might be a little more political of an issue.
There's more medical.
I think, you know, people... Dubai is a big spot. Singapore is a big medical tourist spot. Those places are going to be generally safe. I think when you talk about South America, then it becomes a little bit more of a, you have to be very careful where you go, I would say, right? So There's very good surgeons in Brazil. There's very good surgeons in Colombia. Even in Mexico, there's great surgeons, right? But I think the problem is there's a lot of bad surgeons and there's less regulation there. So I think you have to do your research. You have to know who you're going to. And ultimately, you know, I think you just have to be very careful. Make sure, you know, I think also the other thing is like, you speak the language. I mean, if you get stuck in Mexico or Brazil and you don't speak Spanish, Portuguese, whatever the local language there is, how are you going to get around? How are you going to ask for help if you're in trouble? You know, sometimes safety standards outside of surgery, like muggings and drugs and shootings and things like that, can be a concern. So, there's definitely a safety issue outside of surgery when you're going out of the country.
Yeah. That's why you literally get what you pay for, guys. Like, it's just remember that. Like, if it's, if they are saying we have a sale and it's only 5,000, why are, why, one, why would a plastic surgeon need a sale? And then two, why is it so cheap? We got to ask ourselves these questions.
Dr. Bates, what is your feelings about surgeons in general that advertise outside of like before afters or social media where they're literally like, I lived in Tallahassee. There's billboards for the place in Destin where back in the day you could get a $2,500 boob job. Like billboards, sales, money off, deals. And like, I understand sometimes even my plastic surgery will do like 1,000 off breast dogs, or they'll do some kind of like, not a deal, but it's not like everybody gets a $2,500 boob. Also back in the 2000s, so a little cheaper that.
I mean, this is a personal thing. I mean, I know plastic surgeons do discount, not everyone, but some do and some run specials. I tend to not like to do that. I don't like to kind of devalue my work. But we do generally, we do give discounts, like, kind of the more you spend, the more of a discount you get. So we have like a tiered system where if you spend, you know, in this range, maybe you get like 5% off.
Discount standpoint, but from like an advertising.
Oh, advertising. Yeah, we don't really advertise that either. I mean, we discount like sometimes our fillers, our Botox, our injectables, our lasers, just to get people in the door, I would say. But we generally don't really advertise like discounts for surgery.
So really, that would be a red flag if we're seeing a lot of,
You know, I wouldn't say a big red flag. I mean, I would definitely be careful because that either means that surgeon's not busy or they don't value their work or they're not a plastic surgeon potentially. I mean, again, I think if the price is too good to be true, and I think you've got to look at the region, even in the U.S., right? You've got to look at the region. So I have friends who practice in Beverly Hills. And I have friends who practice in New York. Those two price points are different, and they're certainly very different from what you would pay in Orlando. But if you are going to, you know, there's a guy in California who's a bariatric surgeon who does some, cosmetic or plastic surgery, and his costs are what it costs to get these things done here in Orlando, but way cheaper than what it is to get it done by a plastic surgeon in Southern California, right? Like, a lower body lift in Southern California is probably like $80,000 to $100,000. This guy charges $20,000 to $30,000, which is about what it costs here with a plastic surgeon. So I think you've got to look at that too, right? Like, does this make sense for where I live or where I'm looking to have surgery? Or is this person way cheaper? Again, for us, it's the Miami $3,000 BBL. So
that's what you guys have to battle is dealing that's what with we the have Southern. To
At and the same so, time, like, I mean, Sorry, I'll say this one point. But for me, I don't, this may sound bad, but I don't mean it in a bad way. The patient who's looking for a $3,500 BBL, my only advice is bad idea, don't do it, it's unsafe. But I don't think I'm competing for that patient because that patient, unfortunately, probably wouldn't afford a BBL by a plastic surgeon. So I feel bad for them because I'm like, I get that you want to enhance, you know, you want to look better, feel better. This is something you want to do for yourself. I say do it safely. I would say save up, find some other way, you know, wait 3 years or 4 years and save up to have it done. But I, you know, when you talk, because you talked about like advertising, that's a totally different patient population. I think that we're not going to ever advertise or, you know, they're not going to come and see us for a BBL. That's actually one of the reasons I tell my office staff, like, you have to give people an estimate or a range of prices on the phone Because before we did that, people would come in, get a quote for a BBL, and they would see my, it would basically go to our financial coordinator and say that, like, they sometimes would just straight up walk out of the door, yell at them. They would tell them, well, I could have gotten this for, you know, $3,000 in Miami. And it just creates a lot of problems. So that's not the same patient population that I'm advertising to.
No, you're not.
And sorry, back to your point.
No, I was going to say, like, that's basically the problem is if you're, I think it's a red flag if we're seeing billboards advertising like that. And it's because we, there is people that would, that don't care about safety, or maybe it's just not their number one priority. They would rather be like, well, it's worth the risk, right? It can't be that bad. And guys, we're here to tell you it can be that bad. If you haven't watched all those crazy reality shows about it, like, then take us for your, for our words. Like, it's not worth your hell and you actually not getting the result that you want. Like, you work hard for your money, right? Like, every dollar counts. So, like, why not make sure you're safe while you're getting, like, this kind of big procedure you're doing?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's not just your body, it's your life, right? I mean, again, the risk of DVT, the risk of death, the risk of bleeding, those are all real things that can happen with surgery. So,
yeah.
What are some reasons people may want to consider traveling as an option? Because, like, one of the things that always surprised me is, like, rural areas tend to be really expensive. And, like, I didn't really think about that. It's just because I guess they don't have competition or, but I, besides price, which I think is what a lot of people think of are reasons to travel or go to another place. What are some other?
I would be surprised that rural areas are very, very expensive, at least compared to, like, again, like, you look at, like, New York, it's much more expensive. I mean, even looking at the price of consultations, like, I have friends who charge $500+ for a consultation in New York. I have friends in Southern California who charge $1,000 just to have a consultation, right? You won't find that in Orlando. As far as I know, no one's charging even close to $500 for a consult.
Do you get the $1,000 if you sign up for surgery?
I think a lot of that, yeah. Oh. Like, for us, it goes towards the cost of surgery. Yes.
Right. So that's what mine always were. But in California, do they keep the $1,000 or do they put it towards the surgery?
I think it goes toward, I don't know all the details, but I can tell you for sure that the cost of a consultation is not, for most doctors, maybe unless they're starting out and they're just trying to get some business, you know, someone's been in practice for 5 to 10 years is probably $500 enough for a consultation. Because I think, A, they don't want to waste their time, which I get. I don't want to waste my time either. And the reason it's so expensive is just the cost of living, right, in California, in Beverly Hills, in Newport Beach, all those areas. Too,
that guy, if he's going to see you, that means he's not operating.
Right.
He's not in the OR.
Correct. Right. Correct.
So we got to come up with the, you know.
Well, but also, I mean, think of the time, the value of an hour in, let's take Beverly Hills, right? The value of an hour in Beverly Hills, he's got to pay his rent, his staff, and all that is costing him more than what it costs me in Orlando and what it costs the guy in New York. He's got to pay all that. And yes, he's not operating. So he's got to figure out, like, how am I going to see patients, but also be able to, like, make this day make money for my office and pay my overhead.
That's completely fair. Is there, like, a day that you just do consultations and that's just it? So that way they're not, like, chopped up in between other patients?
Yeah, for me, because of the way my practice is set up, it's usually Thursdays is my clinic day. And then I'll occasionally add, like, a Friday every 2 to 3 weeks just to catch up. So I usually have 1 to 2 clinic days a week. But there are some surgeons, especially if your OR is in your office, where it's easy for them to, you know, see a consult, do a quick case, go pop back and see another consult or a post-op while they're turning over the room right between patients, and they just bounce back and forth. I don't have that convenience because our office is a few blocks away from the OR, so it wouldn't really make a whole lot of sense. So
you wouldn't say that's a red flag if you're noticing that in the office.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
I wouldn't. Again, I mean, as long as it can be, right? If you see other things that are kind of fishy or weird, I think then it becomes a red flag. But I don't think it's a red flag to by itself, let's say. And then Ashlyn, sorry, to answer your question about what's another reason, I think expertise, right? So if you're looking for something that not very many people do, if you're looking for someone who does a lot of one thing, you're looking for the guy who did Kylie Jenner's augmentation. So there's certain things people will travel for. Like I said, we get people from all over. So there's some things we do that not very many people in the world do, and people will travel for that, right? And pay for that.
What is that? What do you do?
I know, you got to tell us. The world.
So, one of the things I don't think very commonly done, like a forearm reduction or a calf reduction. So people with loose skin all the way down to the wrists or all the way down to their ankles. A lot of people can do a brachioplasty, but not very many people are comfortable taking it all the way down to the wrist. Same thing with the thighs. We'll do a thigh plasty, but not comfortable taking it all the way down to the ankle. So we have people travel for that. I think just general like body contouring things we have people travel for. Gynecomastia, male plastic surgery, not very many surgeons do men or do a high volume of males. And so sometimes we've had, like I said, the patient from Connecticut, he was a male not long ago who came down and had surgery. So.
Well, and I wanted to point out that you handle like people that have had big weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
So guys, that's a big difference too. Like you want someone, especially if you're had extreme weight loss, our skin is different. So we need to have someone that knows what they're doing. I would not be comfortable going to someone that's in, because we have a few in Eugene and Portland that can do these surgeries that like you do, but they're not well-versed in extreme weight loss. And so I wouldn't want to do that.
The like training you had and like how many people in the U.S. like to me, I was like, oh, I didn't even know that was like a thing you could look up.
Yeah. So at UPMC at Pitt, there's a program for surgery after weight loss. And so it's a very unique fellowship. It was a 1-year program. There was some, I did take call and do other things pretty rarely, but I'd say 90 to 95% of that 1 year is dedicated to post weight loss patients. You know, again, the vast majority are post bariatric, but some are just diet and exercise or lifestyle modification patients. Back then, GLP-1s weren't a thing. So, But yeah, we did hundreds of patients that year.
How many surgeons come out of that program? Or how many are practicing today that have this level of specialized training?
So they take one fellow a year, and they don't have a fellow every year. Ironically, most of the people who've come out of there are international. Also some in Canada, they've had a few from Israel. They've had, I think, maybe one or two from Europe or Turkey. And they generally tend to go back to their countries. One of the guys who did that fellowship is back at Pitt as the fellowship director. He's actually one of the two who trained me. And then Dr. Peter Rubin is the one who founded it, and he's been doing post-bariatric contouring for over 20 years now.
So how many currently practicing plastic surgeons have this training?
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. Yeah.
We're talking like under 10, under 20, under 50?
Probably under that specific fellowship, probably under 10, I would say. Yeah.
Holy moly.
Yeah. It's probably like a 15 to 20 year old fellowship. And like I said, a lot of them were international. Joseph Michaels. He's famous in the kind of Virginia, Maryland area. He was one of the fellows from there. Ronald Bosshart, I think he ended up, he was at Rochester and then I think he left and went elsewhere recently in the last 3-4 years. Jeff Gustinoff is the one who's back at Pitt. Myself, and then I don't know that there's been another U.S. one since me, and I was 7 years ago.
Are there any other programs like that?
So Joseph Hunstad, who was in Charlotte, he's retired now. He was in the Charlotte area. He had a large portion of his practice was plastic surgery after weight loss. Very good friend of mine did his fellowship. He had a fellowship.
Okay.
It wasn't all post-bariatric contouring, and I don't know that those patients are to the extent that the Pitt guys do. And then there's another surgeon, Dennis Hurwitz, who ironically was also in Pittsburgh, and he had a fellowship some years and some not. His wasn't exclusively post-bariatric contouring, and I actually got to train with him too, which was kind of cool because he was in the same city and was on staff at the university, even though he was a private doctor. So both him and Peter Rubin are very big names in plastic surgery, like authored several textbooks, you know, they travel internationally and lecture. So I don't know how many fellows they have around, but it's probably a dozen or so, 20. But I think the bigger question is like how many of them have focused their practice on post weight loss patients. Oh, yeah. And I don't think it's a lot of them.
That's incredible, though.
Like, you need to brag about that more.
Yeah, Dr. Beta's like, you're an anomaly. You're a unicorn.
I was like, going to say one of a kind.
I don't know about anomaly. That. Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, because like there's not many in the United States. So it's like, yeah, like why? And that's kind of like in my brain as you're talking, like, yeah, why would I want to go to this Turkish place that wants to give it to me for free when I can have someone that like literally has done a full fellowship that specializes in bariatric like surgery, weight loss. Like,
what percentage of your practice now would you say is post weight loss?
It's probably 60%, 60-70%.
Yeah.
But it's all, and my practice is all body contouring. So about 5 years ago, I stopped doing face and neck surgeries, right? I think one of the other things, you know, you talked about, like, why would you travel? So someone, I think, who has, like, dedicated themselves to that procedure you're having, right? So, like, the other day, someone reached out to me. They need, like, their ear fixed. Not, like, a little earlobe repair, which I'll do here and there for someone I know. I don't really advertise it. But, you know, she'd had, like, a cancer resected from the top of her ear. And she needed that fixed. And she was like, will you do it? I was like, no, I don't. Like, can I do it? Yeah, I can, like, open up a textbook and remember how to do this surgery. And I was like, but no, you don't want me doing that. Like, you want someone who's doing this, you know, five times a month or 10, you know, 50 times a year. And so I texted around some friends and connected her with a surgeon, and she'll probably have to travel because I don't know anyone in town who's an expert in that. Right. Well, there was one expert, but he's a pediatric plastic surgeon and can't see adults. So, because of the system he's in. So yeah, she's probably going to have to travel, right? But I think that's a reason to go see someone. Like, you want it done and you want it done right, and you're willing to put in the commitment for that.
What would you consider a large... So let's say someone wants to get something not out of this world weird, but just like your average...
Like a third boob? What's...
I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think of something. Not like, okay, like forearm reduction. That's very specific. Like, how many, if a surgeon said, I've done this many of this procedure, what is the cutoff that you'd be like, ooh, that's enough, that's not enough?
What's not enough? I want to know.
What's not enough? That's a good question. I usually tell patients when they ask me, like, what I should ask a doctor is, like, how often you do this, right? Like, if you ask someone, if you're going to see someone for a facelift and you ask them, how often do you do this? And they're like, twice a year, probably not a good number. I mean, again, not a great number. In my mind,
faces. They need to be doing faces all day, every day, because you can't hide.
Like,
that
they
shit
should be doing anything. 5 to 10 a month, right? Yeah, 5 to 10 a month, easy.
Okay, you can cover your belly button, you can't cover your face.
Yeah,
that's why I don't want to fuck with my face. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I think same with breast reductions, right? If you're like, how often do you do these? Like, once a month? Yeah, maybe that's okay. Once every few months? No, go see someone else, right? Again, look at results. But again, like, someone can show five breast reductions over the last 10 years, and that might be the only five they've done. So I think frequency is important. Like, how often you do them? Do you still do them? Like, did you do five breast reductions a month for the first 10 years of your practice, then you stopped and now you're doing faces and now you're just going to throw in a reduction? That's not a good, you know, not a good idea. So like I was saying earlier myself, I just wanted to be very good at, you know, a limited set of procedures, and I dedicated my practice to breast and body. And I don't want to say it's like, I'm trying to think of the right way to say this, but like, people often ask me, like, my weight loss patients, I want a facelift. And it's like, sucks to tell them no, but it's like, I don't do them anymore. Like, you don't want me doing your facelift, right? And they're kind of disappointed a lot of the time. But I think deep down, most of them end up kind of appreciating that telling them no for their own good or their own benefit. So I think people appreciate that at the end of the day.
So I'm going to assume this is a red flag, but I'm just going to put it out there so people hear it. If say I go to a place and they have like a book of like the before and afters, right? So you can see. But if you are looking through the before and afters and notice like, because yours are very you, like you can tell like you have the same underwear, you have the same like setups. And if I'm seeing like different stuff, like we're like, you know what I mean? Like different clothing or like different, even just like in the rooms that are, it's not even in the same place anymore. Like, is that a concern? Like, what do you think? Because I'm skeptical online just because I'm like, you guys are probably pulling this from anywhere and everywhere. So
it's funny. I mean, that could be a red flag. I will say, even in my practice for the first few years, you know, we had a hard time getting our staff to standardize photos. Like, it took me probably 4 years to get to a point where we ordered underwear that was standard. We didn't just have patients in their own like Victoria's Secret panties, like pink one day, blue the next, you know, flowery patterns. I mean, our backgrounds were mostly consistent. We had generally like a room where we did photos in. But yeah, I mean, I guess you can ask and figure out if the answer they give you is fishy or believable. But I will say this, even for myself, I think if you see that, it kind of is not a testament, but maybe speaks to the surgeon to some degree, right? Like, I hated using those pictures. I didn't use most of those pictures for before and afters. And I was very neurotic with my staff, and you can ask them. I have like a photo chat where I'll tell them, like, I'll usually sit in the office after 5 p.m. and they'll come in the next morning to like 30 messages where I'm like, this patient, they're at a 30 degree angle instead of 45 degrees.
You don't have a thing on the floor that.
Yeah, we do, but that doesn't mean that the people like.
Oh, okay.
The patient's not always doing the right thing.
I always have a struggle. I'm like, okay, I gotta put my feet right.
And the staff's not always like on top of it, right? And so, or sometimes like I'm like, you did front pictures only, and you didn't get back pictures. On like a patient that did 360 lipo. So they'll come into those messages the next day and they're like, okay, we know Dr. Bates was here late last night looking at photos. I'm neurotic about it. So,
okay. So I think I would want someone that's neurotic because that means they're going to be very particular about your
surgery. Neurotic about, right, other things, right? Yeah, that's kind of my point.
Potentially, not necessarily a red flag, but maybe not good fits. I remember I went to one surgeon and I was looking through his book and I noticed that every single solitary one was a relatively thin lady to begin with, who probably worked out a lot, had a baby, and then they fixed her tummy up to be perfect, perfect. And I was like, do you have anyone in here who was of a different weight, a starting weight, or had extra skin? And he was like, we do, we just don't put them in the book. And I was like,
That's definitely a little bit of a red flag.
Right, and I think he kind of thought that I was offended, which I wasn't necessarily, and I thought about it, I was like, yeah, I guess that is offensive. But it was interesting because it was like, I don't want you to see the ones that I don't view as perfect before. I don't know. I just felt like the book was not what I actually found very comforting is when we were going, Dr. Bates and I were looking at some where you were just like, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and I think that one. And it wasn't like, I'm going to give you this curated, these are my absolute, I don't know. They were all good, but I think it made me feel more comforted. One, some of the people look like me, because that was important. Because
yes,
if you're, because I've had clients that were like, I don't understand why I didn't get the results. I looked in the book and all, and I asked them like after the fact, I'm like, did you notice in the book if there are any like people that had a lot of extra skin? Or they're like, you know, come to think of it, they like had extra skin, but not like me. And I'm like, they probably had a baby, and that's what their extra skin was not from weight loss, and so. Yeah.
It's different.
Again, I think not necessarily like a red flag because, you know, I don't know. They may have a reason for it, or maybe, again, they don't do a lot of it, but it's like.
It's a yellow. Caution.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that word, the yellow flag.
Yeah. And I didn't go with that surgeon. That interaction, we had a couple issues in our interaction, but that I was kind of like, why do these people look normal?
I think you bring up.
Do you operate on supermodels?
I mean, you bring up a good point, right? And not to say we always tell patients, just because you see someone in a before and after that looks like you, that doesn't mean that you're going to have the same result, even if it's exactly the same body shape, right? Like, fat can be distributed differently. Maybe we talked about something and then you opted to have something else. And then that's, you know, like I told you need lipo and you're like, well, I don't want to pay for lipo. That's going to give you a different result from someone who does everything that we've talked about. I think the other thing to keep in mind for everyone out there is surgeons are going to generally show their best, at least what they deem as their best results, right?
Right.
Even if I have social media consent from a patient, if I'm like, I don't love that result, or I didn't exactly like how that turned out. So if you don't like the result you're seeing and they deem that to be an acceptable result for social media, probably ought to be like, okay, then if this is kind of their best work, and you don't like it, then probably not a good idea to see that surgeon or have a consult with them.
Which I will say, a different consultation, I remember we were talking about the skin on my lower back, and he kept showing me these pictures, and I'm like, none of these patients have butts anymore. And he couldn't understand what I was worried about. Like, we were both looking at the photos, and I was like, okay, so see how in this photo, like, you reduce this, but now they don't have, like, the butt shape anymore. Yep. And he, like, could not see what I was talking about, and I was like, okay, note to self. This is a no, because
yellow flag.
He didn't right. He didn't see what I saw as a problem.
Right.
This is also kind of back before I think BBLs were a thing, and that we were actually like people wanted more of a butt versus less of a butt. And so I think in his mind he was like, "We're reducing it to make you look thin." But for me, I was like, "I've never had curves, so I would still like to have a butt, and I would like to have." That was the other thing he kept talking about, hip reduction, and I'm like, "No, no, no, I want more of that." And he was
more
like,
"More hips."
More hips. Okay. Like, I could tell in his mind, he was like, why would you want that? Don't you want to be thin? And I'm like, I do, but I want to be like thin through here. I was like trying. And then it was so funny.
I want to look like a lady, bro.
Right. Yeah, I was like, finally, I told him, I was like, I'm going for like Coco's wife. And he like, I remember he was like, or not Coco's, like Ice-T's wife. I could tell in his brain, he was like, wait a minute. I was like, no, I'm not being serious. But I'm like, I would like to look like a woman. And he was like,
small waist, big hips.
Right. And that was back before. It was so funny to me when then that became like the
hip dips,
the in thing. And then it had a name. It had a name.
What is it called?
Hip dips, or a snatch, more like a, like the actual, what, a snatch weight. Like, it was funny because I asked my current plus the one that did my recent. I was like, can you show me what you think of as a snatch waist on me? And she's like, oh yeah, pull it here, we would do this. And I was like, okay, yeah,
that's yeah, she knows about.
She was like, okay,
you get it,
you get it. So Ashlyn, I have a couple questions for you. So as the therapist and your client, you know they're going to go through this, what kind of questions are you asking them to make sure they're doing it safely?
Yeah, so this is kind of the tough part, because in therapy, people can choose to do unsafe things. And it's not really our job as a therapist to stop them. I know that sounds odd. Like, we do have the conversations around it and like what to look like. I probably will go a step further than maybe some therapists, just because I have experience in it. Yeah. But if I'm hearing things like, well, they were the cheapest, I could afford them, then I'm okay. Well, like, let's talk about what that actually means.
Yeah.
Are we taking unnecessary, because to me too, there's a mental health component to that, right? So are we taking unnecessary risks, or are we making decisions impulsively potentially because we really, really want this and we believe it'll, oftentimes the impulsivity is going with something else. So because then someone will love me, I'll be dateable, I'll be able to live my life. And like, that's then as a therapist, I'm like, oh, we got to work on that part, not necessarily the like safety versus unsafe. Cause my in is going to have to be from a mental health standpoint.
Yep.
If someone's doing straight up like elite, like I'm going to go get butt injections. This was like a thing, right? Yeah. I'm going to go get butt injections from this guy that my friend knows in Miami, and it's only a couple hundred butt. And I'm like, okay, so like
in his garage or in his,
for real though,
in a storage, hotel room,
in a this actually
happened, storage, and I was like, "Do you know that there is no FDA approved butt injection?" And she was like, "What?" I was like, "There's no medication." I was like, "Do you know what they're gonna inject in your butt?" She's like, "Well, no, the butt injection stuff. Is that correct? There's no technically
no."
I think you could put like Cabela, like for reduction, but not anything for volume, right?
There's a couple of new products now that are
good. When I said this, it was correct.
Yeah, these are like very new, like in the last No, yeah. Maybe like 10 years. But I mean, a lot. If it's a few $100, you're definitely getting something illegal.
Right. To me, I'm like, I had heard about women who put, they got cement and, mm-hmm. and. Like, or scary stuff.
Or liquid silicone.
Styrofoam.
Silicone, yeah. That's what it was. I was trying to remember. I was like, what was the weird stuff?
That liquid they kept... liquid silicone, which is, I've done maybe 10 of those. It? Yeah, I've had to remove it. Those are usually multi-stage operations, and the results right. are still that less than ideal.
That I will intervene on. Because, one, it's highly illegal. Whoever is doing it is taking advantage of them. Mm-hmm. It can kill them.
I mean, do you have an obligation to, I guess, like have them report? I mean, because you may not even know where they're going. I mean, you might find out, but so, do you have an obligation to report them or?
No.
Can you tell them to report them? I mean, it's like.
I encourage the client to report them. If I think it gets up to a level of, like, there are different routes I can take that aren't necessary. It's just the problem is that you have HIPAA.
Yeah.
So and so I can't disclose. If they came to them and put a gun to their head and said, if you tell anyone about this, I'm going to hurt you, then I can, because there's like harm, potential harm involved. But
right.
But even if it's an illegal, so like I am, and I'm sure like we have some things and I should know this better, but like
runs the same of like, if a client comes to me and is like, I'm using crack cocaine, I can't call the police on them. Like that is always within HIPAA.
People but there's a difference between them harming themselves and doing something illegal and someone else doing something illegal and harming them.
I don't think I would honestly, for me, I would have called in this case. I didn't because she didn't actually do it. But if she was like, no, Ashlyn, I'm going to go do it, I would probably call my liability insurance, talk to the lawyer. So therapists can call their liability insurance. We can talk to a lawyer usually immediately and we could say, hey, what is the ethical, like I have an ethical dilemma. I would like to report this because if there are a vulnerable adult, I could, because I could, but it would be, again, I would have to do some gymnastics and I would want a legal consult to say, I consulted with a lawyer. We decided to break HIPAA. This is why. And then usually they send me a document that says, this is what we consulted on. This is what we decided. So like totally ran. I had a client that stole my wallet. I knew exactly who it was. Mm. They then used my card in a store and it was them. But my thing was like, can I break HIPAA and say that that's my client who stole my wallet and I saw them using my credit card? And so, yes, I can, because I'm a victim of a crime. So, but again, I had to call my liability insurance. I had explained to them what happened. They had to say, okay, hold on. Let me look it up. Let me give you the specific thing. Yes, you can. This is how you're going to do it. And this is how you're going to state it. And this is how, like, you have to have a level of knowledge that it was them. So it's good because then people know when they come to therapy, they can talk about anything because I can't. Like the other thing is like if someone's killed someone.
Some things are not protected.
Correct. But it's
suicide,
very. So
homicide.
If you are going to kill them, yes. If you already killed them, no, because no one's actually.
Well, right. Yes.
Because
like intention
dead.
To commit suicide or intention to commit homicide.
Correct. So hold up. If I killed someone.
I know we're opening a can of worms here.
I know. It's totally fine.
And this has come up.
If I killed someone, a decade ago, and I finally come to terms and tell you, you can't tell anyone?
No. Mm-mm. And that has come up for me.
What?
Yeah.
I thought that was completely.
But if you go to her and you're like, I'm going to go kill Dr. Bates, she has a duty. She actually has an obligation.
You have to tell me how and when
what your plan is.
You can't just
be
that motherfucker, I'm going to blow him away.
You have to say,
I have a gun, I'm going to shoot him tomorrow. Because the thing that isn't in the law, but is for us, if you have the lack of insight to tell me that, you are not in a good state of mind.
Yeah.
So, I had a client that came and told, like, there's only one client I've ever had to bake her act for homicidal intention. She told me exactly what she was going to do, how she was going to do it, and why she was going to do it.
Yeah.
And she had no thought that I would stop her because in her mind, she had every right to do it. And it was the most stupidest reason to murder someone. So I'm just like, we have to protect you.
Well, homicide, not suicide.
Homicide, yeah. It was homicide. And it was a case, too, where I was afraid she was going to do it because she was not in the right mind. And then not even mean, like, come to and be like, oh, my God, I just killed this person over this very stupid reason.
Don't answer this if you can't, but was it her husband?
No.
Cole.
then that's like even worse kind of in my head. It's like, oh, this is like,
no, that
really
was part,
this is so you, premeditated. It's like not even funny.
But part of why I had to Baker act her was the relationship made no sense.
Huh.
Mm. Oh my God, even worse. So I wanted to bring up something that we talked about before offline, yes, real quick, because of Miami and how I've had a friend that actually has gone there. I wouldn't consider her a friend, but I know her. I know of her. And she legit, guys, went to Miami, got it done for the $5,000, and they wheeled her in. And it was like, she said the OR kind of looked a little weird. And I really don't know what that means. Because
if you've gotten to that point, though, it's probably too late to turn back.
It's, right?
They've,
yeah,
probably already given you some drug and you're drowsy. And
yep. And so she went through with it. But like legit, she was only in office like after that for 2 hours. They put her in a wheelchair and was like, all right, time to go. And that's what they were doing
red
to
flag
everybody.
Pushing people out too quick. Nothing dry. Now, I will say my last surgeon always
would tell
you.
We've had a few complaints about that, too. I feel like patients always think they're here.
And that's why I literally wanted to say this, because my surgeon made a very good point the last time. She's like, I want to put you in the car and I want you to kind of go back to sleep in the car, because I had like an hour 15 drive. She's okay. Like, I don't want you to be so awake and so alert that then every bump and every like feeling you're I was like, okay, fair
never
enough.
Really
now, she
that,
still but wasn't pushing me like out early, but I think, yeah, we did talk to like, you may not want to be fully awake when you get in the car. So that way you like kind of go back to sleep, chill out by the time.
Yeah,
and then usually by the time I get home, I'm feeling more awake.
Well, I mean, so just the counter, the explanation to why, you know, nurses want you out, right? So A, usually if you're at a surgery center or a hospital, you're not the only patient they're taking care of. There might be like, you know, like a breast aug, right? That's a 1 hour surgery. You shouldn't be more you should not be in the recovery area for more than like 30 to 60 minutes, unless you have like uncontrolled pain, unusual nausea, vomiting. That's, again, very unusual, but that's probably the big reason why you might need to be there a little bit longer. Otherwise, like an hour later, they have another patient coming in, right? If they're just doing back-to-back breast augmentations, and another hour after that, they have another patient coming in. So at some point, it's like, okay, we can't keep eyes and vital signs and safely monitor four patients. So we have to get people in and out quickly, right? It's some, to some degree, like a throughput thing. And really, there's no need for patients. If your vitals are okay, you've tolerated some juice and crackers or whatever they give you there, there's no reason to stay. I had a lady, maybe in the last few weeks, I won't say specifically when, she got out of surgery. We did a breast revision, took out her implants, put new implants in, did some mesh, did some lipo. We finished with her around maybe 9:30 or 10. She was the first case of the day. And then she wakes up and she tells the nurses, I'm going to be here till 8 p.m. because I paid for the surgery. The nurses are like, 8 p.m.? What are you talking about?
Is it even like open that late?
I was saying, are you guys even open till 8 p.m.?
I mean, the hospital is open, right? But they handle that pretty well, but they were like also all fired up. Like, how can she think she's going to be here this late? Like, this is breast aug revision.
Long time. I didn't want to chill there that long.
Yeah. I don't know what her deal was too. Like, they were like, her vitals are fine. You know, she's claiming she's not in pain. She told, this is all like secondhand information. The nurse was like, she told me she just wants to sleep here. And I'm like, go sleep at home. Why do you want to sleep in the recovery area?
Because
very strange.
You feel like if something happened, someone would be there to assist. That's all.
I don't think that's what her, I don't know that's what her concern was.
That would be my reason, is that. So how it is.
Because it's like, if that's your concern. So like I'm a slow waker. I really struggle, especially if we're using general anesthesia. So like for many reasons, the first set of surgeries I had, I always stayed overnight. And so that way it's literally super slow. But like I paid for that.
Yeah. If you pay for the overnight stay, then fine. But.
But I mean, it was like on purpose. I didn't pay to stay in the recut. Like, we got me out of there.
Yeah, this was not that. And I'm not really sure what her like intention or motivation or like thought process was.
Yeah.
Maybe she was like out of it after anesthesia. She did eventually leave at like 3 or 4. But I mean, that's still a very long time to be in recovery after a breast case.
So what is the typical like time frame? Like, you know how like I would want a 360 and then the lift with like fat deposit. So what does that look like? Am I only going to be there for a couple hours or?
Afterwards, yeah, probably an hour, maybe more than an hour, probably like 90 minutes to 2 hours. And you may not remember the first like 30 to 60 minutes that you were in the recovery room, right? Like you might still be waking up and groggy. But generally, yeah, from the time surgery's done till someone's leaving after like a 360, probably about 2 hours.
And then I would have someone come get me, and then we would go to the recovery house.
Recovery house. I think that has a bad connotation in Miami.
It does. It does. It's just that for me, it's like, I'm going to go to an Airbnb.
A hotel,
the
Airbnb.
The house in which you are going to recover in.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So, okay. So then that's normal. Because that actually freaked me out when, I mean, I know that she went to a chop shop. Like, that's what we figured it out afterwards. Got looked it all up. But, like, realizing, okay, like, so that is pretty normal. Even for me, when I go to you, I'm really only going to be in there for about 2 hours after surgery. So
after surgery, yes.
Yeah, after surgery. So just be mindful of that. Okay. And then what, do you call them at home at all and check on them, or how does that work?
I give most patients my cell phone number. If they have any problems, they just reach out to me. The practice always has someone on call too. So if for some reason I don't answer, which I don't think has ever happened. I've had a few patients text in the middle of the night, which I don't get. I always tell them, like, if it's late and you're concerned, call me.
Call.
And then it's funny because during the day I tell them call the office because I'm usually operating and no one's checking my phone. What was the question? Oh, do we check? Yeah. So usually the nurse, usually we see you the very next day. And if not the next day, within like, 2 to 3 days, generally someone will call them the next day from the office just to check on them, see how they're doing, make sure they're getting up and walking again, you know, preventing blood clots, taking their medications, eating, hydrating. I mean, all the kind of the big things we want to make sure patients are doing. But we will see them the next day or within 2 to 3 days after surgery.
All right. Do you guys think we missed anything when it comes to traveling? Is there anything that we need to cover that we haven't? I just want to make sure you guys are all safe, guys. It's very important. Remember, this is your body. This is your life. Like, I know me, I would want it to be in the best hands that I could ever find. So, and if that means I have to stay for a few years, then so be it, right?
Yeah. I think, you know, look at results. If you're traveling, for sure, you want to make sure you're traveling to someone with expertise. Try to fish out any red flags during the scheduling process, during the consultation process. I don't know if your friend Mel that you referred to, we've heard a lot of practices in Miami. Again, we hear a lot, I say Miami just because it's close to us, but it happened. We've heard about it from everywhere, where they had the surgery and then they have no follow-up.
The
surgeons
follow-up.
They try to call them like, hey, I have a question. I have a problem. The staff's not answering. The surgeon's not answering. read reviews. Take them with a grain of salt. Like if someone has a 4.7 star and they have a few 1 stars, I've got that, right? Everyone's going to have some unhappy patients. But if you're looking at someone with, 300 reviews and a 3-star rating, there's probably something there. So make sure they're up, going to take care of you after surgery and not just kind of abandon you, which is illegal, by the way. If that's happened to you, you should report that doctor or that practice. What else? And then make sure they're safe. I think that's the big thing, right? You just mentioned the smell. You're putting not only your body, but your life in this person's hands. So if you feel anything is off, I think trust your gut. You're never going to go wrong. See another consult, ask people about the surgeon. I've had patients maybe who were like, I've had a few women who were like, I'm so scared to have this surgery. Like, I'm not sure it's the right thing. I probably had like 3 or 4 of those in the last, 7, 8 years at this point. I think it's very powerful if I've told them, well, how about I put you in touch with this other patient who felt the same way as you, and now like is, ready to like book her next stage. I think that's helpful. So I guess it's kind of weird, but you can ask your surgeon, like, do you have anyone I can talk to? But again, they're going to pick and choose who they
often do that.
Yeah.
You
have to be careful though, because your surgeon's picking who you're speaking to. So they may, send you to someone who had a great experience, but, those would be my 2 or 3 things.
I think those are all good ones to just be aware of. Ashlyn, did you have anything?
Listen to your gut. If something feels off, if something feels weird, if something feels not quite right, listen to that. This is not something that must happen right now in general. So we can take our time. We can make a choice. We can get more information. We can, like, there's, especially if you're, like, a surgeon is pushing for you to, like, you know, like, that may be something, and maybe we didn't talk about that. But, like, if you have a gut, if you see something, like, it's operation day, and someone's being wheeled out, and they're bleeding profusely, and you're like, whoa, like, my friend who had surgery was bleeding profusely as they rolled her out in hopes that no one would see her. And it was like, oh, if you go in and you see something weird like that, now some of it's just going to be new to you. So, like, you know, having like mine was in the office. It's an OR in the office. It still feels kind of weird. Like, I walked in and I'm like, I am walking myself into the OR. I've never done that before. That's kind of odd. That is odd, but it's not a, and then mine's particularly, there's a door in the back and it literally opens to the OR of the hospital, which is nice. But it felt weird more from just, I've never been in this environment before. I've had many surgeries. I've never had anything in an office that, like, looks like an operating room. That's different than a gut feeling like the surgeon is talking in a way that is making me feel really uncomfortable, or I can hear the staff talking really negatively, and or, like, there's something just off. Like, it's okay to listen to your gut. It's also okay to ask questions, advocate for yourself. You can always back out. Yep. I remember for one of my surgeries, I almost passed out. I have low blood pressure, and my blood pressure was high. They gave me a beta blocker, and then their surgery got delayed. And so the beta blocker started working, and I was, like, laying down. And when I stood up, I fell. I also had POTS. I didn't know at the time. And so I remember the surgeon came into the room and was like, we don't have to do this today. Like, it's all good. Like, if you don't feel, and I was like, oh, hell no, I am off work. We are going to figure this out. So she was like, okay, let's get you some fluids. Let's see. I was the last patient of the day. It wasn't a big deal. But part of me, you know, but I remember thinking, is she someone who would come in the room and say, it's all good. We don't have to, you know, clearly that's not a production, you know, like someone who's a production is going to be like, absolutely. Like, who cares? Like, let's keep it rolling. Mm-hmm. Let's keep going. Like, that made me feel good knowing that in her mind, it was like, your safety, how you feel is at most important. And I'm like, can't ever think of a gallbladder surgeon doing that. But, you know, it's like, no, we're going to get this done today. But I think, again, like, listen to your gut. You can always turn back. If something doesn't feel right, like, I don't care if you're wearing their robe, get up and walk out. Like, send them back the robe if you feel bad. Like, leave, you know, I don't know. But it's like, you can always do that.
You can get up. Yeah.
Yeah. So listen to your gut from a mental health. Do not do things that are illegal.
To get this done.
Don't do things that are illegal to get this done. Do not take unnecessary risks. Like, think about that. Like, I want this so bad. I'm willing to take a risk I would never take in any other circumstance. Yeah. Like, not good. But yeah. Good.
Yeah. I was going to add, actually, and you said it too, that it's almost never too late to back out. Even the morning of surgery, you've spent money, you've spent time, you've arranged for aftercare, you've taken time off, you've done all the arrangements, maybe you have kids. But at the end of the day, you want to come home to your kids, right? And you want to have the results that you are paying for. So if you notice anything fishy, even the morning of surgery, I wouldn't be afraid to at least ask the questions, you know, speak up, delay, you know, do whatever it takes to kind of make sure that you are fully comfortable. You know, and I think, Ashton, you said your surgeon demonstrated that perfectly, right? Like, hey, it's not late. It's not ideal, but I'll delay you if we feel like this is the safest thing to do for you. I mean, I've had patients where, I'd say most recently, the one example I can think of, I had a Jehovah's Witness, and she's anemic, and she's a Jehovah's Witness. She's already starting. Yeah, not a good combo, right? So we're starting low, and I warned her about all this, right? I think one of the other things that good surgeons do is they try to predict problems before they happen and warn you about them. So I told her, I'm going to start with you. We were doing arms and like a fleur-de-lis, I think, if I remember correctly. And I told her, I'm going to start with one part and I'm going to close it. Usually I start with one part and I move on to the next while my assistant's closing the first part. That's where we're going to start with that, close it, and then we're going to check your hemoglobin levels, and if we're still comfortable with where they're at, then we'll move on to the belly. There's no point in cutting open the belly and starting there if I'm not comfortable. And sure enough, her hemoglobin had dropped enough. You know, maybe she got too much fluids from anesthesia, so it kind of looked low. But she'd already started low, and we can't give her blood. So we did the arms, checked her hemoglobin. I was uncomfortable. I stopped. And again, I think for a little bit, patients might be one of those situations where they're not, you know, obviously they're not happy. But I think ultimately they appreciate that we took their safety first, right? And didn't like cut corners or do everything we talked about just because they paid for that day. And we gave her money back and told her to come back and do it once your hemoglobin levels are back up. So,
oh, see, even better. Guys, this is what you're looking for. These types of situations where people and the surgeons are willing to be like, okay, this is too much. And I want to thank you guys all for one, like listening to the podcast and making sure you guys are safe. We just want all of you guys to do things like knowledge. Knowledge is power, whether we like it or not. It's huge. And yeah, I thank you guys for being on the show and telling us all the deets on what to do and where to go and how, like what to look for. So, until next time, guys, be safe. And let us know if you need anything. Drop it in the comments. Bye.
Bye.